So last time we were discussing one of the four parts of yoga, which we call karma yoga, of course. As I said at the very beginning, yoga is an attempt to speed up the evolution of our psychological and spiritual life. And generally, it is divided into four categories to suit the various temperaments of people. There are people who are of an active type, who generally do a lot of work, not much given to contemplation or devotional practices. For such people, the great sages of ancient times have prescribed karma yoga. I mean, taking karma or making use of karma or action, our daily duties and responsibilities for our spiritual life, performing our duties without selfish motive, with a sense of complete attachment towards the results of our actions. It's called unselfish activity, becomes a tool to break the chains which normally bind us to this world. Any action done with selfish desire creates a sense of bondage within us when we are too much obsessed with the result of our actions. We become enslaved by actions. Anyhow, we have to work. But when we work with a strong motive and a strong selfish desire, we have to work as slaves. But the same actions, if we perform without selfish desire, we can do as masters. So this is what we explained as karma yoga. Now, in today's class, we will discuss another aspect of yoga, which is technically called jnana yoga, which is based on philosophical inquiry. In karma yoga, we sublimated, we gave a spiritual dimension to our natural tendency to be always engaged in work, physical work, intellectual work, any kind of work. As I said earlier, even a thought is a kind of work at the intellectual level, mental work, as much as physical activity. Now, all these activities are given a spiritual dimension, a spiritual orientation when we practice karma yoga or yoga through the path of actions. In jnana yoga, which means yoga as the path of wisdom, we try to analyze the real meaning of existence, the real meaning of our life. What is the true nature of man? Is man just a psychophysical mechanism? Is he just a human body or a body-mind complex? Or is human being something more than just a psychophysical mechanism or a body-mind complex? Now, Vedanta tells us that a human being is not just a psychophysical mechanism. Because if you define a human being only in physical terms, then you have to admit that a human being is not very different from the members of the animal kingdom. Human beings need more refined, more sophisticated tools for enjoyment. Animals are satisfied with primitive tools of enjoyment. Again, advanced or highly evolved human beings may look for more organized way of enjoying this world. But animals don't have that kind of equipment. Otherwise, there is not much distinction between the members of the animal kingdom and human beings if you define a human being just as a physical mechanism. Now, But you know very well, if in fact any student of human civilization or history can easily understand that man is something much more than this body, this psychophysical mechanism. Because every attempt to look beyond the body, to look beyond the present, to look beyond the visible, beyond the empirical, is a proof positive that a human being is not just a psychophysical mechanism. It is said in Vedantic texts, in Indian philosophical tradition, it said, the highest concept of absolute reality is in direct proportion to the development of intellectual and spiritual development of a human being. See, a primitive person thinks of the absolute reality. You may call him God, or you may call him the absolute ideal, whatever you may call. For a primitive person, God is somebody who sits, who creates this world, and then sits above, supervising his creation, ready to punish or to reward. Now here what is happening is, a man is projecting his own idea of God. So his idea of God is almost a reflection, is an objectified form of his own idea of the highest concept of life. Now, as you evolve further and further, you come to a much higher understanding, a higher concept of God. So in Vedanta, God is not the just the creator of this world, or supervisor of his creation, or distributor of hell or heaven, or comforts or punishments. God is the immanent principle present in all living beings, not only in human beings. Everything in this world is pervaded by the divine principle, which we call Atman in Sanskrit, which is normally translated in English as Supreme Consciousness, the Divine Consciousness. So this reality is the immanent principle, which is the residing principle present in all living beings. And it is the all-pervading, omnipresent reality. It is also the transcendental reality. This is the highest idea of the absolute reality of existence of God. Now, when we turn this inquiry inward, we always feel that the present state of life is imperfect. In fact, every attempt to look beyond, as I said earlier, to look beyond the present, beyond the empirical, is a proof that man or woman or human beings are not satisfied with the present state of affairs. When you try to enjoy poetry, when you try to enjoy a classical piece of art, literature or mysticism or anything, any idea that goes beyond the present, beyond the empirical, beyond the physical, is an attempt to transcend, to go beyond the body level. Now, what is the true nature of human being, human existence? According to Vedanta, as I said earlier, we are by nature perfect. Then when we live in this world, when we get associated with all the empirical experiences, we hypnotize ourselves into the belief that we are part of this world. We are suffering, we are enjoying, we are conditioned, we are affected, we are influenced by what happens around us. Then the real purpose of spirituality is to dehypnotize, to remove, to decondition. Now we are already conditioned by the external circumstances. So when we live in this world, when we become part of the worldly phenomena, when we identify ourselves with what goes around us, we feel, well, I am suffering, I'm enjoying, I'm no happy, I'm unhappy, and so on. But when we decondition ourselves, dehypnotize, when we break this link which connects us to the empirical external world, then we realize that we are beyond all this. So in Buddhism, this is sometimes called that highest level of nirvana, the highest level of liberation, the highest level of enlightenment. In Vedanta, this is called the realization of our own true, real nature. And this is actually the purpose of human being. So when we turn this search inward, then we realize what we are. When we turn the search outward, then nature reveals its secrets. But when we turn this inquiry inward, then we understand our own true nature. So this search for the transcendental, search for the true nature of life and existence, constitutes the central theme of Jnana Yoga. Jnanam itself means wisdom. Wisdom stands for spiritual wisdom, which enables us to understand our true reality, our true nature. We are not this body. We are not just this mind or psychophysical mechanism. We are something beyond all this. We are the supreme consciousness, for which this body, mind, intellect only constitute different media through which that reality expresses. I shall try to explain this in the light of a dialogue from one of the most ancient Vedantic textbooks. It comes in a famous book. It's called Upanishad, Taittiriya Upanishad, one of the Upanishad. It is in the form of a dialogue between a son and his father. The story goes like this. See, one day, a boy approached his father and asked him, "Please teach me the true meaning of life, the true meaning of existence, the true mystery of this creation of which we are a part." The particular paragraph begins like this. I'm just quoting from Sanskrit. I shall explain and interpret in English. Bhruguvai varunihi varunam pitaram upasasara adhihi bhagavo brahmeti. This is how that particular paragraph begins. So remember, we have to remember this book is at least 5,000 years old. One of the Upanishads. The name of this boy is Bhrigu, and his father's name was Varuna. One day he approached his father and asked him, "Please teach me the true meaning of existence, the real source of the universe, the mystery of creation." That's what it actually means. Now, the father doesn't ask the child to believe in anything. What he says is, see, you look around and see this natural phenomena, mountains, rivers, valleys, oceans, and so on. Where do they come from? Who sustains them? Who maintains them? And just imagine what would happen to them in future. This is how the father begins his reply. Annam pranam chakshu sotram mano vachamiti yato va imani bhudani jayante yena jatani jivanti yat prayanti abhisambhishanti. I'm quoting this verse because in case you, any of you happen to read Taittiriya Upanishad, you understand this. See, the meaning is this. Just think, try to understand the original source from which all these natural phenomena emerge. And the mystery which sustains them, and also just try to understand what happens to them in future, where they are going, where they are coming from, and where they are existing. This is the question. Now, And then the father tells him that instruction is given. How should you go about your investigation? How should you begin your inquiry or investigation? The meaning is given, tapasa brahma vijignasasva. Meaning is this, you try to meditate on the meaning of this natural phenomena and try to realize this. Now remember, the father is not giving a long talk. He is not teaching him any book. He asked the son to meditate. Means turn the inquiry inward. Swami Vivekananda, who is the founder of the organization of which this retreat center is a part, once said, when a scientist turns his inquiry towards the external world, nature reveals its secrets. So when a Newton investigated into the true mystery of the external nature, then he discovered the theory of gravitation. So also Einstein, all the great scientists were also sages. In fact, all genuine scientists are seekers of truth. The only point is they are inquiring, they are turning the inquiry towards the external nature. They are trying to investigate into the external nature of the mystery. A saint or a sage in ancient times were also scientists, but they turned their inquiry towards themselves, into the internal nature of existence. So this father told this boy, you try to understand the mystery of creation, the meaning of life, the meaning of existence, the true nature of human life by turning your inquiry inward through meditation, through introspection. And in the same text, this long description, this boy started meditation. After several weeks, he felt, well, this world as we find, the world which we live in, which we experience, of we are a part, is all that exists. There is nothing beyond. That's what this boy felt. And he went to his father, I have discovered the meaning of life. See, all these are true, nothing beyond this. You know, this is sometimes called pantheism in Western philosophical tradition, in which you equate ultimate reality with nature. God is equated to nature. It's a kind of primitive concept, no more accepted, of course. Now, that was the first stage of the evolution, spiritual evolution, of this process of meditation. And then he went to his father, I have discovered the truth, this world, natural phenomena, for all that exists, there is nothing beyond this. Then the father said, well, you are wrong, you continue your investigation, you continue your inquiry, means you continue your meditation. He didn't make use of any books, mind you. He didn't listen to a series of instructions. He just meditated. In fact, this part of the ancient text reveals the path of inquiry, the real process of Jnana Yoga that we are discussing. And then this boy continued his investigation, he continued his meditation. At the second stage, after several months of meditation, he thought he has now discovered the truth. He said, vital energy. Energy is the source of creation. Energy is what maintains this world. So, you know, energy remains same according to the principle of conservation of energy. Energy remains same. Energy takes different forms. So, from matter, which in Sanskrit sometimes called annam, this little boy, through his process of meditation, reached the second stage of spiritual evolution. He thought there is something beyond matter, beyond something much more subtle than matter, and that is energy. So he said energy is the source of creation. Energy is the sustaining principle behind existence. Then father said, no, you are wrong. You continue your investigation. And then at the third stage, this little boy thought mind is the source of everything in this world. And this is sometimes very logical. Even in the 18th century and later, according to the philosophy of subjective idealism of Berkeley, and also in the ancient Buddhist philosophy, it's called Vijnanavada. There was a school of subjective idealism in ancient India during the period of Buddhist philosophical movement. According to the Mahayana Buddhism, there is a distinct school of thought. They also believe that everything is mind. World exists only so long as your mind is aware of the existence of the world. External objects have no independent existence, no status of independent existence apart from mind. So everything exists in mind. That was the belief of the ancient subjective idealists who flourished in the third century AD. And also even according to Berkeley of modern times. Then also this father was not satisfied. He asked the boy, you are wrong, you should continue your inquiry. At the fourth stage, this boy thought, now he has reached the supreme goal of his inquiry. He thought, intellect is the source of creation. Everything is created by intellect. After all, the world exists only so long as we are intellectually aware of its existence, so long as we are able to recognize its existence. The moment we forget about the existence of something, it is as good as non-existent, so far as we are concerned. So, at the fourth stage, this boy, his name is Bhrigu, thought that intellect is the source of creation. It is intellect which creates this world, and world exists only so long as we are intellectually aware of its existence. And the moment it disappears from the realm of intellect, it vanishes. Then also, at the fourth stage, the boy went and told his father, no, I realized the truth is the intellect which creates everything. Then also the father said, you are wrong, you continue. At the fifth stage, the boy discovered the truth, but he came to his father and he did not say anything. He kept silent, which means he has realized, he has reached his goal. Then he realized it is Atman or Supreme Consciousness, the immanent, the omnipresent, the transcendental reality, which is the source of existence. And it can never be explained, it can never be described, it can never be defined. It is beyond words, beyond definition, beyond description. And the moment you realize this intuitive experience, then you realize that what you are inquiring into is not different from yourself. The investigator realizes that the object of his investigation is non-distinct and non-different from the investigator himself. You can find an echo of this high Advaitic non-dualistic philosophy in the works of Meister Eckhart, who was a great Christian mystic who lived in the 13th century. He also says, the knower and the known merge into one. Now, this enquiry is the path of Jnana Yoga according to Vedantic tradition. Now, this idea is pushed in another language. in the oldest of Vedantic tradition, the oldest text of Vedantic tradition, which perhaps you might have heard, it's called Rigveda Samhita. There is also an equally graphic description of the reality. The idea is stated like this. A scientist or a sage went in search of the cause, the final cause of the world. He did not find it in the external world. And ultimately, he discovered that reality within himself. Sato Bandhum Asadi Niravindan Hridi Pradeshya Kavayo Manisha. Some time back, one of our devotees discussed this point in this class. I gave a long description of this particular verse. It is called, it's a famous hymn in one of the oldest Vedic texts, where a sage is described as discovering the true meaning, the final cause of existence within himself. Now, this process of Jnana Yoga takes us to the highest concept of ethics. Now, the central theme, the fundamental doctrine of this Jnana Yoga is the unity of existence, the spiritual unity of existence. From a spiritual point of view, existence is one. Not only humanity, the entire existence is one. And the real justification for the highest morality is not fear of God, but the truth that existence is one, humanity is one, therefore by doing harm to another person, we are doing harm to ourselves. By hurting another person, we are hurting ourselves. So, though from one point of view, it is the highest metaphysics, but from another point of view, it also assumes the role of the highest ethical philosophy. Because the foundation of the ethical philosophy is the universalism of the principle, which tells us, which teaches us that entire existence, entire human family is one spiritual entity. That means the infinite oneness of the soul, of the reality, is the ultimate sanction of the highest morality. This is from the philosophical point of view, from metaphysical point of view. Now, how does it relate to our human life? This is the other aspect of Jnana Yoga. On the one hand, we have the highest idealism. The highest idealism, which teaches us that entire creation is one, humanity is one, existence is one, that from a spiritual point of view, there is no such thing as other person or anything other than ourselves. Human family is just one spiritual entity. This is the metaphysical part of this. Now, from the practical point of view, if you analyze, you will realize that the same non-dualistic philosophy also is the highest realism. On the one hand, it is the highest idealism because it teaches us that existence is one. From a spiritual point of view, the entire human family is one entity. This idea is explained in the language of a dialogue. If you read any of these ancient Vedantic texts, which at least the latest of them belongs to the third millennia BC. And oldest of them may be 7th millennia BC. It's ancient textbooks. In one of these textbooks, there is again another dialogue which gives us a glimpse into the practical aspect of this philosophy. It is also in the form of a dialogue between a teacher and a student. Here also, the student is a small boy. You feel just like in pre-Christian Greek philosophy, where the highest philosophical discussions always took the form of dialogue between teachers and students. So also in ancient Vedantic and Vedic metaphysical works, the highest metaphysics was always discussed in the form of dialogues, discussions between teachers and their disciples. Open discussions. So this also taken from one Upanishad, it's called Kathopanishad. It's also in the form of a discussion, a dialogue between a student and his teacher. The student's name is Nachiketa and the teacher is Yama. The story goes like this. I shall give an outline of the story and will try to stress the metaphysical, the spiritual content behind the story. One day, a small boy was watching his father as his father was engaged in giving away gifts to his guests. So in those days, a charity was an important responsibility of householders. If you read these books, you find that every householder had to conform to certain disciplines, certain social conventions. So charity and generosity were highly valued virtues of householders. So the father was engaged in giving away his gifts to people, to poor people. A rich man. And in those days, you know, cows, horses, and elephants. These three constituted the currency of those days. People used to make use of kings and rich merchants traded in horses and elephants. And ordinary people, of course, they traded cows. So this his father, the boy's father, was giving away cows. Now, instead of giving good cows to poor people who came to seek his care, he was giving away old cows which can't give water, which can't give milk, which can't drink water, which can't eat grass, such things. So old cows which can't serve any purpose, which can't give milk and which can't drink water. So this boy noticed this duplicity of his father's character and went and asked him, "Well, whom are you going to give me?" This is the question he asked. You see, there is a cultural element in this question. In those days, the son was the most precious wealth of a father. So the boy wanted to draw the attention of his father to the fact that his father was giving away most worthless animals, pretending to be a man of high charity. He won't lose anything, at the same time he will get a good name as a charitable man. He had gotten, his name was Vajasrava, which itself means a man of high reputation. But he was a man of high reputation, but at this particular time, he was giving away useless cows. So the boy wanted to open his eyes. And the father got angry. "He is making fun of me. I am going to give you to the Lord of Death. This is the answer here." It's a mythological story, right? We need not go farther into it. Anyway, the boy was told by his father, I am going to give you to the Lord of Death. So the story goes like this. Next day, the boy left his home and went in search of the Lord of Death. You have to remember, this is a mythological story. But behind the story, there is a great spiritual and metaphysical truth. That's what we are going to discuss. Now, and he reached the home of the Lord of Death. And when he reached there, Yama, that is the name of the Lord of Death, was absent. He returned only on the third day, and till he returned, the boy waited for him, hungry, without food, and the host got very much upset, and in return, as a compensation, he asked the little boy, "You can ask me 3 boons. I shall give you 3 boons in compensation for your sufferings, because you waited for me in my absence, waiting for me. You were hungry and thirsty. You didn't take, because the boy didn't eat or drink anything during the absence of Yama. Now, these 3 boons, in fact, represent 3 levels of human spiritual investigation. That is the significance of this Upanishad. The first boon which the boy asked, you have to remember, this boy left his home after a little quarrel with his father. So father would be angry. So he said, "When I go back to my home, my father should not scold me." That's the first boon which the boy asked. "When I left my home, my father was not very pleased. He was a bit angry with me. So he should not scold me when I return home." Now, in fact, this is what every person will look for in his or her material life. First, we want that our material life should be perfect, happy and contented. We want to lead a happy life in this world. Domestic life, money, status, wealth, job security, all these things should be perfect. This is the first aspiration of any normal human being. We may not worry about what happens to us after death. We may not worry about the transcendental values, the meaning of life, the ontological ideas behind existence or being. We won't bother. We will only bother about our day-to-day needs related to day-to-day life situations. So this boy, the first boon that this little boy asked was this: "My father should not be angry with me. And then my father should speak to me in a very happy mood." The Sanskrit verse I shall recite. Later you may make use of this record. Shanda sankalpa sumana yadhasya vida manyo gautamo amma abhimrutyo tot prasishtam amma abhivade prasida edatrayanam prathamam varamprine. This is the ancient Sanskrit verse. Meaning is, I already explained, when I go back to my home, my father should not scold me, he should not be angry with me, and he should speak to me in a very happy, peaceful mood. Which is the first stage of human spiritual evolution. Okay. Now, as I said earlier, the Lord of Death had promised 3 boons. The first boon, well, it was immediately granted without any doubt. All right, you take it. When you go back, your father will be happy. He will not scold you. He will welcome you back to your home. Now the second boon that this boy is asking is this. Now, he thought, I have met the Lord of Death himself. So, and he is the one who decides, who determines how long I could live in this world. And he had granted the first boon, which means I shall be able to lead a very happy life in this world. I will have no sorrow, I will have plenty of wealth, and I will have a very happy family life, everything. But what happens to me after death? So I want to enjoy the same comforts even after death. In fact, that is the second stage of human aspirations. So you find in all Abrahamic, all monotheistic religions, there is the concept of heaven. In heaven, you see, God is very happy, angels are willing to receive us, and we are able to lead a very happy life, peaceful life, which is very normal for any refined human being. So the second boon which the boy is asking for is this: I should be able to enjoy long life in heaven. That's the second goal. You can very easily understand, this is the second stage of human evolution. In all ancient civilizations, in Hindu, Christian, Buddhist, Hebrew, the ancient Greek, Roman, Egyptian, Babylonian, Assyrian, Aztec, Mayan, Indian, all civilizations you find this higher concept of existence. After death, we must have a very happy, we must have a continuation of the same happiness that we have, that we enjoy in this world. But then, of course, this the second boon is explained in another verse. Sattum agyam surgyam adyesu murtyu prabhuhidam saddhadhanaya mahyam saddhadhana abhrutam bhajanda edatrayanam tithiyam varam prane. The meaning of the verse is this. Surgyam means I want you to teach me that science which helps me to go to heaven. I want you to instruct me that sort of religious rituals which will help me, which will make me fit for going to heaven after death. This is the second boy. But Nachiketa, this little boy, doesn't stop there. Because if you go deeper, if you contemplate a little deeper, you understand heaven is nothing but an extension of worldly pleasures. What you enjoy in this world, you can enjoy in heaven without any expenditure, without any trouble, any difficulty. So what is heaven? Heaven is actually an extension of worldly aspirations. Of course, that aspiration comes only to a refined, educated, evolved human being. Not necessarily highly evolved in a spiritual sense, but a person who thinks beyond the empirical, the phenomenal world, who thinks there is something beyond sensory pressures that we can have in this world. Only such a person can think of a transcendental existence, though it is only for enjoying pleasures, because heaven is nothing but an extension of worldly pleasures. So Nachiketa, this boy, doesn't stop there. You have to remember, these ancient texts are trying to explain the highest metaphysics in the medium of a dialogue between a student and his teacher. That's what you have to remember. There's a lot of mythology behind this. See, a boy going to the Lord of Death is absolutely a mythological concept. But then, these three boons which Nachiketa asks for represent three levels of human spiritual aspiration. That's what we are concerned with. So first, he wanted that all his worldly comforts should be satisfied. And was given. Then he thought of what happens to him after death. So in this world, the Lord of Death has given me all pleasures, promised me all pleasures. But after death, what will happen to me? So he wanted to continue the enjoyment of worldly pleasures. So he wanted to go to heaven. But immediately, he recognized one truth. Even heaven is not eternal. If you do a lot of good meritorious deeds, you can go to heaven, you can enjoy. But when the results of your meritorious virtues, good deeds are exhausted, then you have to be reborn again. That is the belief in Vedantic tradition. So Nachiketa then asks for the third boon. In fact, it is here that Upanishads take us beyond the physical, the phenomenal level of life, our existence. Because here Nachiketa is requesting Yama, his teacher, to explain to him the mystery of death. That's what actually he's asking for. The third boon, he asks, see, some people tell me that when a person dies, that is the end of existence. It is mean life is a straight line progression according to some traditions, philosophical and religious traditions. And according to some other traditions, of course, life continues, but then it is a continuation of this straight line progression. In heaven it continues. And according to some other people, it doesn't stop there. This life is not the end of the journey of existence. This life is only a semicolon, not a full stop. So, existence was explained in terms of a cycle in Vedantic tradition. You live in this world and you do good deeds and bad deeds, and according to your karma or your deeds, your actions, you are reborn and then continue enjoying the results of your actions. And in this manner, the cyclic existence continues till we realize that we are something beyond this body, we are the Supreme Consciousness. The cyclic rotation continues. There is only one way to get out of this wheel. And what is that? What is that method? According to Buddha, he called it Nirvana. According to Vedantic tradition, we call it the realization of the truth that we are Atman, that we are the Supreme Consciousness, the Supreme Existence and Supreme Bliss. This is the Vedantic dictum. Now, Nachiketa, this boy, wanted to know the mystery of death. But actually, if you go deeper, you understand the mystery of death is the same as the mystery of life. Because death, if life is nothing but a preparation for death. And how we live decides how we die. So, when Nachiketa's boon, it is contained in one verse, Eyam preti vijikitsa manushi asti tige nayam asti dijayige yedat vidya manushishtas toyaham varanam esha varastrudiya. This is the third boon which is asking. I have already explained the meaning. He says, according to some people, this life is the end of the journey. When we die, existence comes to an end, so far as we are concerned. According to some other people, no, it continues in heaven. But according to some other people, it continues even beyond that, and we are reborn. There is something beyond this body, beyond this intellect, beyond this mind, which is eternal, which is everlasting, which doesn't undergo any change, which is the Supreme Consciousness. Please teach me this mystery of death. This is the third boon which Nachiketa is asking for. In reply to this request, in response to this request, the teacher explains to him the highest Jnana Yoga or the highest spiritual wisdom. The teacher tells him, this existence is not one. Your true nature is something beyond this body, beyond this intellect, beyond this mind and thoughts and everything. It is something eternal. It is Atman. And this Atman, as the indweller, is present in all living beings. It is an immanent principle. And it is also the source, the sustaining principle, and the point of dissolution of the entire existence. It is present in the minutest of the minute. It is also present in the grandest of the grand. So, in fact, the literal translation of one verse in this Upanishad comes very close to modern physics. The meaning of this verse is this, Anoraniyan Makutu Mahiyan Atma Sijintohu Nikitam Guhayan. The literal translation is, this Atman, this transcendental principle, this immanent omnipresent principle is present in the minutest of the minute. Anu actually means atom. The literal translation, it is present in the minutest atom. And also, it is present in the grandest, the largest thing that you can conceive of. It is the one reality which is existence, absolute, knowledge absolute, and bliss absolute. It is the only everlasting reality which is unchanging. Everything else undergoes changes. This is the true nature of human being. I should continue the same discussion next class. Today we have already come to the end of the lecture, and now we can have an interaction discussion. I should continue the same subject in the next class. So we can whatever discuss subject you want to discuss.
I have a question for you. When we use the word knowledge, most people understand it as the worldly knowledge, you know, knowledge of books or, you know, whatever has been taught or studied and all. And that has nothing to do with the jnana implied in the jnana yoga.
That
should be made very clear, because otherwise, you know, people think that really more and more.
And
jnana yoga is the process of undoing or unlearning whatever we have learned. It has to be, you know, just annihilated. So that jnana has to be taken in the right meaning.
It is a problem of translation, a problem of language, you know. In fact, it's an accepted principle among all philosophers and thinkers that language can never be an adequate tool for expressing the highest philosophical ideas. That's one problem. So, see, jnanam is a term used in Sanskrit. It is translated into the word knowledge. But knowledge normally implies objectification of an object by mind. When you know something, that object which you know becomes the object of mind. That's what we normally understand knowledge. But here, it is an intuitive inner experience which we cannot normally equate with knowledge. See, I know about this means I know this is a book. This book becomes objectified by my mind. Mind is subject and this becomes an object. Here in Vedanta, it is an intuitive experience. But then, you know, as I said, language can never be an adequate tool for expressing the highest philosophical ideas, which are based on experience. Experience can never be explained. Experience can only be experienced. So that's one problem. You know. This problem always exists. So in most translations, you can find this problem. Knowledge is a term used, so very often they use capital letter K, but that won't be always enough in translations. Because experience can never be objectified by mind or intellect. So this is the idea. So in Vedanta, jnana means in inner experience, intuitive experience, what we call mystical experience normally. The highest transcendental experience. An experience which immediately gives you the feeling when there is nothing beyond this that I should see. That's the experience we are talking about.
Swamiji, you, at the beginning of your talk, you had a very profound quotation, and I wasn't able to get it all down about the direct proportion, the highest. You had a quotation about the highest, probably, form of spirituality. There's a direct proportion to the highest.
A quotation?
Mm-hmm. Or you spoke, it sounded sort of like a quotation or some kind of formulaic.
Yes. You find it comes in the Kathopanishad. If you have got a textbook, you can if you write down the first word, then you can get from the index. Yay, yam, that's how it begins. Means that's a boon which Natsiket, the boy, asked of his teacher. Mm-hmm. Where he requests his teacher to explain to him the mystery of death. What lies beyond life? What happens after death? This body perishes. If you are just this body, if you are nothing more than this body, then life is one. Existence is one. But if you are something beyond this body, then something continues to exist even when the body perishes. Body perishes when we die. But if you are something beyond this body, then something continues to exist even after death. What is that reality? That's what he's asking for.
Okay. Yes. And do you know what I'm talking about? It was something like the something in direct proportion to... Does anybody know what I'm talking about?
I said.
I heard.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Towards the end, of course, there is one quotation I said in the... That's also, that comes in the Kathopanishad. Where the teacher tells the student that this Atman, this Supreme Consciousness, is the immanent principle in the minutest and also in the grandest, the greatest things. It is all-pervading. So the word you anoho aniyan makato makiyan, that's how it begins. I don't want to inflict too many Sanskrit verses in a discussion like this. No? So it will be kind of a diversion. So, but if you ask, you can find in the verse is anoho aniyan makato makiyan. This how it begins.
In which Upanishad is it?
Kathopanishad, we find.
Oh, the Kathopanishad.
If you just write down A, N, O, this will do. Then from index, there are books with transliterations of all the verses in Roman script. So you can very easily get it. Because I wanted to draw your attention to this verse, because it is something very interesting. The ancient Vedic text tells us that this reality is present in the atom, in the word atom. In fact, anu means atom. That's the term used. Atom of quark, you can go even beyond minutest of the minute. So minutest of the minute, that's meaning. This reality is present in the minutest of the minute and also in the largest of the large. It is the highest metaphysical principle. So, through our actions, our deeds, and our spiritual efforts, we manifest this inner divinity. And that is actually the meaning of yoga. Yoga is nothing but an effort to manifest this inner divinity. It is present in all. See, one central point to remember is, according to Upanishads, God is not one who creates this world and sits apart away from creation. That's one important point we have to remember. God is the immanent principle present in all beings. God is not an extraterrestrial entity. That's one fundamental point in Upanishad, Vedantic philosophy. God is an impersonal, all-pervading, immanent principle. It is present everywhere in everything. And by actions, by meditation, by introspection, through good deeds, we can manifest this divinity. And when we become really aware of this immanent divine reality, then you can't do anything wrong, we can never do anything which is bad, we can never think or do or speak anything wrong. That's the idea. Otherwise, there's always a problem. If you think of God as an extraterrestrial being, then you have to posit a devil also in parallel to that. If you personalize God, then you have to personalize evil also. So that's Vedanta doesn't accept the theory of devil, it accepts the theory of evil. It doesn't accept the theory of evil, it accepts the theory of error. Vedanta accepts the theory of error, not the theory of evil. We do wrong things because we are not aware of our true nature. So it is the lack of awareness or ignorance that is responsible for anything wrong that we do. It is not the influence of the evil. Vedanta rejects the idea of personalized evil.
Isn't some Vedanta dualistic or not? Is it all Advaita?
Yes. In fact, some Vedanta, I'm talking about Advaita Vedanta or non-dualistic philosophy of Shankaracharya. And there are many monotheistic concepts in Indian philosophical tradition which accepts personalized evil. Hell and heaven and so on. There are innumerable heavens and hells always burning and inviting you. But not in Advaita Vedanta, not in Shankaracharya's non-dualistic philosophy. I'm here focusing on non-dualism. Is that point I want to stress. If you go to the Puranic stories or the monotheistic concepts of Indian Hindu philosophical tradition, you have got many such ideas of hell and heaven and God creating and punishing such ideas. Here I am focusing on Advaita, what we call non-dualistic school of philosophy. That's all. Please.
Can I ask you a question that's not directly related to the text, but about the Vedanta mission in society? Can I ask you a question that's not directly about the text? Not about the text. Is that okay?
Okay, please, you can.
So you know, when you become part of the mission and you, let's say, you become a monk,
yes,
join in.
Yes.
Is everybody getting the same training, or do you decide that you are more of a karma yogi or a bhakti yogi,
yes,
and then you train a different path? Does everybody also train in Advaita Vedanta according to Shankaracharya, or how does it work?
In our organization, there are monks belonging to all the different types of philosophical traditions. There are some who are karma yogins. There are many who are Advaitins. There are many who are the followers of Dvaita tradition. But all of them do accept the central teachings of Sri Ramakrishna. Now, Sri Ramakrishna, who lived in the 19th century, he effected a reconciliation between these conflicting schools of thought. According to Sri Ramakrishna, all schools of thought, all religious traditions are equally valid if the seeker is sincere and honest and mentally pure. That is Sri Ramakrishna's realization. But here we are discussing one particular branch of philosophy. So I was focusing on this Jnana Yoga aspect, you know. But in our organization, there are many monks who follow the Advaita tradition. There are many who follow Ramanuja's Vishishta Advaita and Madhvacharya's Advaita, and there are many who don't follow any tradition. They keep themselves engaged in selfless, unselfish service to the organization, who run schools, colleges, universities, hospitals, and who do relief work when people are affected by natural calamities like earthquakes, tsunamis, and like that. Yeah, different types. That's it. Okay. Philosophy is not essential for God realization or spiritual enlightenment. This is one point where philosophy is not necessary. Philosophy is helpful when we do preaching work. But philosophy has got a great importance because it keeps your mind at a higher level of thinking and higher level of vibrations.
Yeah, I had a question, like, is it right that at a certain stage in the practice of Jnana Yoga, the intellect has to come in terms with itself and its limitations and step down? Is it correct?
Yes.
There is no use of intellect afterwards.
Yes. No. You know, even the Upanishads themselves assert that intellect cannot understand the reality. But intellect helps you.
You need intellect even to know that in the
beginning. Yes, yes, we need intellect. Intellect helps you to remove wrong notions. The example can be given like this, you know. Your question will, in fact, indirectly it takes us to another very important aspect of Advaita Vedanta. Now, Advaita Vedanta, books do not contain the supreme truth. The supreme truth is our inner experience. But books help you to remove wrong notions that we have got. The example is given. Normally, you know, we consider ourselves to be this body, this mind, this body which is suffering, this mind which is angry, happy or unhappy, and so on. We often identify ourselves with all these different entities. We often mistake ourselves to be something other than Atman, the Supreme Consciousness. Now, the example is given here. Suppose there is a dimly lit room where there is not enough light and there is an object lying on the floor. It's actually a piece of rope, but there is not enough light. So one person may mistake that rope for a snake. Another person may mistake that rope for a thin stream of water that is flowing in the floor. And a third person may mistake that rope for a crack on the floor. And a fourth one may mistake it for a curved stick, because the shape and the size of the rope causes different wrong notions. Now what happens when you bring light? When you bring light, the darkness is removed. When you get enough light, the darkness is removed. Then you understand it is a piece of rope. Now, in spiritual life, what is the role of books? The role of books is the same as the role of the light. Light doesn't produce rope. Light only removes the darkness. And once darkness is removed, the rope reveals itself. So, the rope is not the product. Even the knowledge of the rope is not the product of light. The only effect of light is this. Light removed darkness, which was the obstacle which stood in the way of our understanding that it is a piece of rope. Similarly, when we read these books, when we read these different scriptures, when we make use of intellect, when we discuss, when we engage in debates, and when we follow the teachings of great masters, we are able to remove wrong notions. And once wrong notions are removed, then the right understanding is natural. Once you bring light, and once darkness is removed, then you don't require another effort to understand it is a piece of rope. Similarly, when our mind is pure, then the reality manifests within. When the mirror is cleaned of all the dust and filth, then the reflection becomes pure. That's idea. But before that, we must believe in God, we must pray to God, we must meditate, we must read scriptures. All these are very, very useful. But the realization, the experience is our own. That's the idea behind.
Yeah, I think you talk a lot about the Creator, you know, somewhere out in the universe. But I think once we reach a certain level, we should become the creators ourselves. by practicing art, by being in nature,
by
being less in our mind and our head, but being more in our soul and our spirit. And I think the absence of thought is probably a good measure on our path to self-realization. And I think that's what we try to do. And I think we try with all kinds of substances to achieve this. And if that doesn't work, usually it does not work because there will be always a relapse and a downfall. But if we do it through creative, positive action, then we can also kind of lose our perception of thinking. We just enjoy, look at the butterfly, look at the flower, maybe stop and smell the flower, you know? And that's how, I think that's also a spiritual experience. There's an interesting quote, I forgot who made it, but it's because we have a rainy day today. Millions long for immortality, yet don't know what to do with themselves on a rainy afternoon.
That's true. But, you know, in Vedantic philosophy, the ultimate doctrine is there is no creation. Or rather, the creation and creator are the same. But then, this is the last experience. This is not a philosophy. Advaita or non-duality or the ideas contained in these books are not really ideas. They are something related to our inner experience. Now, the point is, at the beginning, we need some belief, some practices. Because when our mind is distracted in all directions by the five senses, when our mind is full of conflicting ideas and confusions, we need a focus. For that, you can adopt a good holy book. You can think of a supreme reality. You can pray to God. Because these activities give you a focus for concentrating your mind, intellect and the senses. And once you succeed in fully concentrating your mind on a sublime spiritual ideal, then you realize that reality is in fact non-different from yourself. But then, this is not a doctrine, this is an experience. Before that, we need doctrines, we need books, we need rituals. It is good. See, if there's a church or a temple or any place of worship, instead of watching a thriller, we can go to a place of worship and pray. At least that will keep our mind engaged in a more useful and a less destructive activity. Or if you read a holy book belonging to any religion, or even if you read a sublime poetry, it is certainly much more helpful than being engaged in some activities which may increase the distractions or confusions in our mind. But as we go further and as our mind becomes calmer, more and more calm, we realize actually the peace that we are searching for doesn't exist outside of ourselves. That peace is within ourselves. At this stage, books and philosophies give way and experience begins. And when experience begins, you transcend books, you transcend ideas, you transcend dogmas and doctrines. That's why in one of the most sublime statements, the authors of this, the sages, the saints and sages, philosophers of the Upanishadic books tell us, the reality is beyond these books. Then why do you bother about reading these books and printing these books and distributing and teaching these books? But these books alone tell us that reality is beyond books. That's the purpose of reading these books. You bring light, not to produce the rope, but to remove darkness, so that we can see the rope for what it is. That's ideally. Because then only we become really spiritual. Spirituality begins with our own experience. not belief. The belief doesn't bring spirituality. Belief can bring peace, no doubt. But ultimately, peace becomes a reality when we really experience with it. Sincere faith sometimes produces experience, no doubt. That's true. Many mystics, you find, they live by faith and they had high duty experiences. Middle Ages in Europe, European countries, also in India, in many Buddhist traditions also, there have been great saints and mystics who went beyond books, who went beyond words, beyond dogmas. But there is a particular point when books are left behind, ideas and philosophies are left behind, you step into the realm of experience. That is the central teaching of this Upanishad. In fact, that's what the teacher of Katha Upanishad is going to instruct Nachiketa in the next class, you can find. He doesn't contain philosophy. Only this reality is experience, and the experience is beyond philosophy. That's all.
Yeah, and the Tao Te Ching also talks too about it, you know, those who talk do not know, those who know do not talk.
Yes, yes.
Beautiful words are not words are not beautiful.
Yes.
But that means it's at another level.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in other words, we would just get together here and don't talk.
But you know, yes, that is true. But you know, there is an interesting even in incident in the life of a great great sage who had reached the highest of experience. Even after reaching the highest spiritual experience, he was always engaged in reading holy books, in puja, in meditation, introspection, and so on. So somebody asked him, "Why are you doing all this?" And he said, "What else should I do? You have to do something."
Yeah.
Even after reaching the highest wisdom, what do you do? You do certain things which your body is programmed, conditioned to do before you reach realization. The body will continue its momentum. He was meditating, he was reading holy books before he reached the level of realization. So after realization also, he continued doing it. But there's a difference. Before realization, he did all this as a means to reach the higher goal. After realization, he did it as an involuntary reflex action of his mind and body. That's the idea.
Like every journey starts with one little step.
Yes, yes, that's true.
Yeah. So how about in the scientific field, you know, about immortality? A Swiss scientist, I forgot his name, in the 80s, got the Nobel Prize for creating the formula about, all solid matter is really nothing but moving molecules.
Yes.
So it's nothing but energy. So we are all, scientifically speaking, we are all really energy. We are 80% water and minerals. So once we die, our physical death, all our molecules, all our thoughts, all our ideas, they are not dying. They are floating around somewhere
exactly.
In the universe.
Yes.
So that's why we are all interconnected and we are immortal in that way.
Yeah,
too.
True. That's the real meaning.
Yeah. So now how, in the Catholic religion, for instance, or Christian religion, is, you know, if you created mortal sins and you die, you will roast forever in hell. Okay, now how would it be in Hinduism or in the Vedanta perspective if you did a lot of evil things in your life? So you die and then you are reincarnated, you have to go through the whole thing again. Or how about, can you ask for forgiveness in the moment of your death, and that will eliminate all the negative karma that you have accumulated at that moment?
Yes, in asking for forgiveness or confession,
yeah.
If it is sincere, that very moment, that person becomes liberated from sins. See, confession is not a renewal of license for continuing earlier actions. real confession actually brings about a transformation in our life. If you read Augustine's Confessions in City of God, you know, real confession, if a person is actually confessing, he's actually repenting. That moment, he becomes liberated. That is true. But it should be sincere. And once he actually confesses with that more sincerity, he can never do evil deeds again. That's why he becomes completely liberated. In Vedanta also it is there. It is in Vedanta we call it surrender. In Sanskrit there are two terms used. One is prapatti, other is sharanagati. Which means when you completely surrender yourself to God, then your individuality is lost and God's personality, God's individuality start functioning through you. Because your ego is completely erased and God's individuality starts functioning through you. If the surrender is sincere and complete, Gandhiji speaks of this surrender as the prerequisite for sincere prayer. See, prayer becomes sincere if it is accompanied by this sense of surrender. That is the real meaning of, that is in fact the psychology of confession. It is not that periodically, mechanically, you undergo a ritual and then continuing from Monday onwards, you continue the same kind of life. That is not the real meaning of confession. Yeah. In fact, that kind of real confession did take place in the lives of the great mystics who lived in the Middle Ages in Christian, in different countries which produced great mystics. Like, okay, fine. That kind of real, that complete, St. Francis of Assisi, complete transformation took place in his life. He was a rich soldier and businessman's son and all that. There was a complete transformation in his life. So he could not continue his previous life. Mm-hmm. That is what exactly Vedantic philosophy or Indian philosophy calls surrender, prapatti or saranagati, complete surrender. Where your little ego is completely erased and God's will starts functioning through you. But this is possible only if we are completely sincere. It is sometimes compared by modern interpretation. See, if you are writing with a pencil or a pen, and if the pen or pencil has its own individuality and starts functioning by its own individuality, then you won't be able to write properly. The pencil should surrender its will completely to you. Then only you can make proper use of the pencil in your hands. So the tool, the instrument should not have its own individuality. See, if we really surrender, then we become instruments in the mighty hands of God. Then confession really becomes meaningful. Otherwise, confession is just a mechanical ritual. It doesn't bring about a transformation in the character of a person. If it's just a ritual, it's not so. So we'll continue the discussion in the next class. Okay.
Quick question. To become, you know, an instrument of the divine, must you take the vow of sannyas?
No, not at all. Not at all. Anyone who is sincere and pure-hearted can surrender himself or herself to God. There is, you may belong to any religion, any creed, any denomination, you may be an householder, you may be a mendicant, whatever you may be. Anyone, God's door is open before everyone. There is no reservation, no special consideration there. Monks only or householders only, nothing of the kind.
But psychologically there seems to be something that happens when when you do divest yourself of your material.
Very often in the institutional sannyasa and the institutional mendicancy in Christian tradition and institutional the bhikshu tradition in Buddhist religion. All these started, there are certain institutions which emerged in later centuries. But in some of the ancient classics of Vedantic or Hindu tradition, there are scores of great men and women who are not monks or mendicants who had reached the highest of spiritual tradition. In fact, the greatest teacher of Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Yajnavalkya, in fact, he is older. Janaka, a great king, he is also a great man of wisdom in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. So this is sannyasa or mendicancy is not at all emphasized. Spiritual enlightenment, spiritual realization is possible for all. There is no such reservation, nothing like that. The institutional mendicancy or sannyasa were later developments. For certain other reasons, you know, for facilitating the study of scriptures, for organizing spiritual life and disciplines, these institutions emerged in later centuries. Okay. Om, peace, 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 peace.